Hello, and welcome to the Joe Downtown Show on KUNV 91.5 FM. Each week, we'll be discussing all things related to downtown Las Vegas, its rebirth, its failures, successes, and the many, many interesting people working and living in a part of the city that, until very recently, has been mostly forgotten, I'd say shunned by residents, tourists, city officials alike. I'm Joe Shaneman, a Las Vegas Sun reporter who also writes a regular column in Las Vegas Weekly. You can find me in both publications and online under the heading of Joe Downtown. If you have any ideas for future shows, please send me an email at joe.downtown@lasvegassun.com or at my Twitter account at joedowntownlv. As you listen, you may be hearing the bustle and tinkling of silverware and dishes in the background. That's because we're taping this at the Beat Coffee House in the Emergency Arts Building at 6th and Fremont Streets. Though the show is taped today, we hope to soon be broadcasting live so we can take calls for comments and questions. So let's get to the show. My first guest today is Kent Johns. Johns and his brother Lance, along with Derek Stonebarger, own The Atomic, a tavern in the 900 block of East Fremont Street that reopened a few weeks ago to rave results from its imbibing customer base. Johns is also a commercial real estate broker who has lived and worked in Las Vegas for well over a decade. He and his brother have an office on Bridger across from the Bank of America building and a few floors up from the new Italian sub place that opened on the first floor of the building. Johns, believe it or not, among his other talents, is an actor who has appeared in short films, including 2013's The Boss, which I recently watched on YouTube. Johns plays the boss in this film of a sort of nefarious group of people. I think he's in charge of a hitman. In person, he's one of the most affable people you'll meet, quite different from the bottom-line-oriented mobster in the film. And he is just one of the interesting people downtown you find almost daily at the Beat and walking around who has his own perspective on the sea change happening down here these days. Welcome, Kent.
Hello. How's it going, Joe?
Pretty good. Say, I met you almost the first day I started writing the Joe Downtown stories back in December. I remember you sat down. I really didn't know who you were. You sort of acted like you knew me and you owned the place. You got up, said you wanted to find a new album to play here, so you went home, grabbed the Godfather album, brought it back, sat back. I could picture you there in your sunglasses, which you always wear, almost smoking a cigar and tapping your fingers on the table.
That's me.
Somehow that was fitting. Exactly, that was you. It was unusual in this sense. I bet you can't imagine doing anything like that even 4 years ago downtown. The change has been so dramatic. What have you seen as a real estate guy? And talk about it a little bit with me.
Well, you know, you certainly wouldn't have seen me downtown east of Las Vegas Boulevard back then. I've been working downtown since the year 2000. January of 2000, we took over the Bank of America building for Irwin Mulaski when it was 40% vacant. That's a 250,000-foot building. And back in the old days, back in the days when Perry Thomas and all the good old boys that started the city, they were all downtown. Well, with the advent of the Hughes Center, a lot of the financial companies moved out. And the reason they moved out is because the outskirts of the city were becoming blighted. So, you know, I came down here in 2000, and Mayor Oscar Goodman was the mayor, and he was really on a big kick to get the re-energize the downtown, because, you know, he loved it because he was from those old days when, you know, like I said, Perry Thomas, Benny Binion, the boys.
Did you really believe in any of that, or just wanted to make a quick buck?
You know, I bought into it, believe it or not.
Good for you. Okay.
You know, I mean, I was down, you know, we had over 100,000 feet of office space to fill at over $2 a foot. Now there was money to be made, of course, but I bought into it. I mean, I believed it. I saw the old buildings. I mean, we had no history in this town whatsoever other than the downtown area. In fact, we bought a building on 4th and Bridger, right across the street from the Bank of America, and that was from me being down here. I was one of the people that were first started trying to sell the Arts District. We brought a guy named Jack Solomon in, and we ended up leasing him with an option.
I knew Jack.
The old Nevada Paints building. We brought him in, and he was one of the first to come into the Soho District in New York, but he didn't buy in. Now, Jack was getting up in age, and he saw this Arts District as an opportunity to get into an area like the Soho District in New York, but actually with some money and be able to buy into it. And Jack really was instrumental in getting the Arts District promoted now, and going.
Now, sort of the difference between Soho and here, though, is sort of a lack of buildings.
Correct.
So I'm just trying to think, 2000, that early on, I really didn't discover kind of this area, I think, until about 95, 96. I guess, what did you see here? Why? Whatever made you think anybody would come down here? At that time, up until 97, everybody was moving to the so-called suburbs. Everything was springing up. I mean, nobody wanted to be down here. I was mugged down here just 4 years ago.
You told me. Yeah. Well, because I had been to other, because I do commercial real estate and because I'm a fairly creative guy, I was able, I've been to different areas in the country. I saw Denver, the old downtown area. When I was there, it was starting to revitalize, and I saw the old buildings, and I saw like a dinner party up in one of the loft that they redid. I've been in New York in the blighted areas where I saw the resurgence, and I had the vision that I could see that someday we could turn this thing around. I was one of, back when nobody was coming here, I was one of the guys that brought the Internal Revenue Service, which Mayor Oscar Goodman at the groundbreaking, he said, "Is there anybody from the IRS here?" And a couple of people raised their hands, and he said, "Cover your ears. I hate the IRS." But he loved them at this, in this scenario, because it brought 300 more bodies a day downtown.
Now, Eddie, we were sitting drinking sarsaparillas at a bar recently.
Correct.
And you were waxing on in real estate terms that I really had no inkling, I had no understanding of. It's these points and percentages and blah, blah, blah. Went over my head, but I have talked to commercial brokers and yourself before who say the interest in downtown from businesses that need large commercial real estate, they want to come down here.
Yes.
I mean, then this is at a time, this is when commercial entities never wanted to come down here because they didn't want to have Las Vegas on their address, thinking that would scare potential customers away. Are you seeing the same thing? Are you seeing commercial interest down here?
Absolutely. But, the problem is, it is only so big. I mean, at some point, there's going to have to be some new development come in.
You mean new buildings?
New development, new buildings. I mean, look at the housing. I mean, look, obviously the Ogden, I can't remember what the name of it was before, but they opened that and it was a beautiful building, and it wasn't like Field of Dreams, open the doors and people will come. I mean, they ended up losing their building, and the people at ST Management ended up coming in at the right time and buying it and being able to lease it out and are running at 100% occupancy, which is pretty much unheard of in most buildings.
Now, is this all because of, the bald guy running the online shoe factory, Tony Shea,
well,
Zappos CEO?
Let me tell you a story. One of the things, I've been working on, obviously, downtown for quite some time, and I had worked with the city of Las Vegas for a long time. I sat on a panel to hire one of their real estate people. We sat on a panel, we interviewed a bunch of people. They've got me on their website, their redevelopment agency website, interview with me. Back when they were trying to do the bar district down here, they actually walked me down here to ask me my opinion of it. And that was really one of the only times I ever crossed Las Vegas Boulevard on Fremont Street. And I was walking with a gentleman named Doug Lean, who happened to work for the city back then.
Remember.
He's not here now. But anyway, we walked back around over on Ogden, where the Ogden now sits. And I was looking around, and I was in a suit and walking with Doug, who's about 5'2", thinking, "Oh boy,
we
have no weapons on us."
Yeah, it was not a pretty place. I wonder if some of the city ordinances might have gone too far. I wrote a story today about the ongoing issue of policing first Friday nights down here. There are so many people, they don't know what to do. And one of the paragraphs I seem to continually rewrite is that within one block here, there are 8 bars plus 4 bar restaurants. A lot of that occurred because of city ordinances that eliminated distance requirements between bars. Should they have done that?
Yes, they should have. And my brother and I, we walked up here, not last first Friday, but the first Friday before last, which was in August? And what we saw, it's not the people that are drinking inside these bars. It's the people that are in the middle of the street that don't, they look like they're the 18 to 22 group that are just hanging out with big chains around and, you know, and drinking bottles out of the back of their pocket and looking for, basically looking for trouble. You know?
You never carried a flask around with you?
Well, I have one. I have two at my house, but
I thought you had to say I have one right now.
But you know, it's not the problem with the bars. I mean, if you didn't have those bars and you had a crowd of people there, these people would still be there. It's not the bars. It's the people who drink in the bars. That's what the city wants. That's what pays the bills.
No, I do remember. I talked to a lot of people about this 5 or 6 years ago on First Friday Nights. This was, it was a great area. It still is, but I'm just saying it was crowded, but it wasn't, you never saw hundreds of people sitting on the street with 12 packs of beer here and there, drinking, just getting wasted.
Do you think they bought that 12 pack at one of those bars?
Who knows?
They don't even have a package liquor license. They didn't.
We got a few minutes left here, but I want to talk about one other thing. You know, despite the fact that we are down here every day, you have a business on the street now. I drink coffee here, more coffee than all the coffee in China.
You've had enough today, right?
But not everybody believes what's happening, especially, well, I guess maybe cab drivers don't fit into this area because they might believe it. They just don't want to give people short rides because they don't make a lot of money. And you have had your experience. Give me one instance of the experience you've had with cab drivers who refuse you to give you a ride.
Well, we were down at the Atomic. A friend of mine that was in from Boston.
Keep profanities out if you can.
I believe I did. We were down at the, yeah, I'll try. We were down at the Atomic, and a friend of mine was in from Boston. And for some reason, every time he's here, he wants to go to the Olympic Garden. So, you know,
that's not a vegetable place, is it?
No, I don't believe it is.
Okay.
Unless you're looking for melons.
Touche. Okay.
But anyway, so we wanted to hop a cab, and I approached one, and he said he's not giving us a ride. And then I approached another. I ran up, and he took off, and the window was open, and I almost jumped through the window because he said he's looking to give somebody a ride down to the Strip. Well, I guess there's not enough from what I've researched. There's not enough cab stands down here. And these people, it's pretty much Target. I mean, if we put more if the city would allow more cab stands, I think we might be able to get around a little better down here on the east side.
But they don't want to. I mean, that's their prerogative. I mean, I don't know. I think it's illegal for them to refuse a ride, but they want to make money. They have to make money. There's competition. I should mention, however, a few months ago I wrote about some cab companies that were giving $50 bills out randomly to cabs. That would pick people up downtown no matter the distance of the ride as an incentive to cab drivers not to turn a potential passenger down. I don't know how that's worked yet. I haven't heard anything.
I don't either, but recently I've been, if I want to go a shorter ride, I just come up and say, look, I'll give you $10 on top of the fare if you give me a ride here, and then that seems to work. You got to give them more money. That's all.
Interesting. So outside of your own bar, What's the most interesting change you've seen happen down here in the last, let's say, 6 months?
You know, it's just the type of person you see walking up and down the street. I mean, I'm sitting here at the beat right now, waving to people that I know. But I mean, it's just a different clientele. I mean, you know, when I walked down here with Doug Lean, I don't know when it was before they decided to do the bar district. I wouldn't. No, I mean, I didn't know one person.
I don't suppose you dared wave to anybody or even look them in the eye.
Right. You know, so today, I mean, I'm sitting here at the window at the beat, and I just saw two people across that and I knew both parties. So, yeah, it's a different world down here, and it's actually exciting. I mean, you know, you got Big Daddy's joint right across the street here. We got the El Cortez, which actually doesn't smell like smoke anymore. It actually smells like powder or perfume. I mean, it's really nice. You know, we've got the Commonwealth here. We've got Letai. We've got the La Comida, which just opened with Michael Morton and Jenna Morton, who are fabulous restaurateurs. I mean, we've got the Container Park getting ready to come online. Of course, the Atomic down there. I mean, if you go on Yelp, you could read some of the best reviews of a place in town, and I haven't seen one bad one, which is amazing.
About your place, the Atomic.
That's what I'm talking about. Oh. The Atomic. We don't. I people told me yesterday, oh, don't read Yelp because everybody gives bad reviews. And then I sat there and proceeded to read to them, and everyone was good, which is, you know, knock on wood, that's pretty good.
Well, I congratulate you on that. It is a fabulous place. I'm going to wrap it up here, Kent. Hopefully we'll have you on again as you move into other endeavors that you've been telling about and as I publicize. I'm Joe Downtown. This has been the Joe Downtown Show on KUNV 91.5 FM. Thanks for listening. You're welcome. Next up is Chris Curtis, known as the face of the Downtown Rangers and a former longtime Metro Sergeant. I'm Joe Shaneman, and under Joe Downtown in the Las Vegas Sun and Las Vegas Weekly, I write a weekly column and a daily reports about everything and all the people that are downtown making it happen. Now, a lot of people think they know what's going on with law enforcement in the growing East Fremont Street corridor, but Chris Curtis really does know what's going on. He's a former nearly 20-year Metro employee whose last assignment was with the Downtown Area Command. Early this year, after being nominated by his own officers and making it to the finals of the Officer of the Year contest sponsored by Officer.com, he retired and now is a consultant for the Downtown Project, and he oversees the Downtown Rangers. The Rangers are a group of, well, I'll call them helpers. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, they walk in pairs downtown, providing directions to people, but largely serving as the eyes and the ears of police. If they see something happening, they're equipped with lapel cameras to record what they see. They won't intervene, but they will contact police if necessary. Now, the question I have for you, Chris, is what are they seeing? I'm here every day, but I'm stuck in front of a keyboard a lot of the time. I should say I've seen gangsters walking around, people I've never seen down here before. There will always be the homeless here. But at the same time, you're seeing many, many more people walking with direction and purpose because they're trying to make a living, starting new businesses and the like. And daily on Fremont, those people making a living are coming in contact with people who might have different intentions. And they're those sort of downtown project-like collisions, if you will. But what's happening in those instances? Give me an idea of what you're seeing now a couple months into the Downtown Rangers.
You know, with me, it's funny because I'm down here all the time. And you said nearly 20 years. Joe, get straight.
What?
It's 20 and a half years.
Sorry, 20 and a half.
20 and a half years. I got love for you, Joe. All right, here's the deal. You know when you have a puppy and you see your puppy every day and you don't see it necessarily growing, but everyone else is like, man, everyone else is like, man, your dog got big. Since I'm down here every day, it's harder for me to see the huge transitions until I leave for a while and come back. What's happening here is some great stuff. I mean, we're sitting in the beat right now looking out of windows, and I see couples and families and just people with purpose doing their things. Now, granted, every once in a while you see, or I see in particular, people who I have dealt with in the past in a police capacity. But that becomes less and less each day. And without bragging, I have to say that the Rangers are definitely part of that. I just took a really interesting class. I got certified in this thing called SEPTED. You heard of SEPTED, Joe?
Is that some kind of cult?
No. How dare you? How dare you do that to me? That's how I'm going to talk for the rest of this interview and say it's not a cult. No, SEPTED is actually crime prevention through environmental design. You know, cops always have cool acronyms. And I got certified in this thing, crime prevention through environmental design. And there are four tenets to SEPTED, and I'm not going to go through all of them, but I'm going to go through one of them. And one of them is natural surveillance. Natural surveillance. And let me just basically explain what natural surveillance is. Natural surveillance is if you set up an apartment community and there's a courtyard where kids are going to play, ideally you would want the windows of the apartments to face towards the courtyard, because people, while they're at home, will look out the window and see that the kids are either playing or doing it. They serve as an extra set of eyes. And I have this saying that says, you don't have to be security to make someone feel secure. And I noticed that the Rangers being down here all the time, create that extra set of eyes, that natural surveillance. They don't have handcuffs. They're not cops. They're not running around tackling people and doing stuff like that. But criminals feel uncomfortable when there are people who are law-abiding citizens in the area.
Well, let me ask you about it. Are the Rangers, I don't know if you talk to criminals, they come up to you, or ex-criminals or people on the street,
Do they talk to me? Do they think?
Do they see those guys and they say, "Yeah, man, what's going on?" Or we don't want to do stuff. I mean, how do you know it's even working? Is what I'm getting at.
Because I was down here as the sergeant, and I saw the kind of activity. Joe, see, you got to think back. In 1992, when I started on Metro, this was my beat. My call sign, no joke, was 1-Adam-12.
That's awesome.
That was my call sign, for real. And I used to walk this beat, drive this beat, and you could, in 1992, 1993, you couldn't come down here without walking a couple of feet and somebody trying to sell you crack. And with that, brought a whole bunch of different stuff. I mean, this is like night and day. It's obviously a time capsule. I mean, granted, it's 20 plus years later, but this is a real community. I remember the other day, I was standing outside with another cop, another retired cop, who also, we worked in that building right there, 601 East Fremont. He was in SWAT, and I was a recruiter. And we used to have to escort people to their cars in uniform, just from here to any of the parking garages around. And we were standing on the corner in front of Commonwealth, and there was a little girl playing with her mom on the corner. And we were tripping out. We were like, whoa, I mean, this is so good to see this. It was surreal because we were reminiscing. And then it was Morton's daughter. And we had no idea.
He's talking about Michael Morton, the owner of La Comida or Comida.
La Comida.
There you go.
Come on, por favor, papa.
Now, let me get to that for a second. I just want to say I'm Joe Shaneman, and I write under Joe Downtown in the Las Vegas Sun, Las Vegas Weekly. This is the Joe Downtown Show at KUNV 91.5 FM. And I'm talking to Chris Curtis.
A.K.A. Sarge,
former 1-Adam-12 guy, and now the head of the Downtown Rangers. But I got to ask you about this. I've written a lot lately about police interactions, especially on the nights of First Friday, when a lot of the First Friday revelers end up coming here after First Friday closes. And a lot of those people have never been in contact with police. They're just rank-and-file citizens who want to see what's going down here.
Right.
Sometimes they have negative experiences with police who, for lack of a better word, treat them rudely. I guess I kind of want to get at... I can't imagine you were a cop like that, but how does that transpire? Aren't the cops always trying to be neutral in these instances? I mean, how does that help them to be rude?
You know what? The fairest way to say it, and you know, for the purposes of the love I have for you, I'm not going to be politically correct at all. I'm going to be real, 100%. All of us have a bad day, Joe. I mean, I was a great cop. I mean, in all humility, I really cared about the people, and it's weird for me to say humility that I was great, but I cared about the people. I think that's what you need to be a great cop. But were there days that I can think back that I was sometimes rude to a person because of whatever? Maybe I was having a bad day, or maybe we just got off on the wrong foot. You know what I used to teach my new cops, man? I used to teach them, there would be times that you'd be in this heated exchange with someone, and I would say, it's all right to say, you know what, can we start over again?
That's a really good idea.
That's the best cop tool that you can possibly have. When you can look at a person and say, you know what, we got off on the wrong foot, let's start it over again. And I think that if the officers and even the citizens find themselves in that type of situation, if you engage in that form of dialogue, that you can start from zero and you can get back to where we both become adults, and it's not about ego. So in talking in generalities about the police, I would say, you know, 99% of the cops, and I hate to use that threat, 99% out there, but most cops, in my experience, are out there trying to do the right thing. And most citizens are out there trying to do the right thing. It's just that sometimes the planets align weird and it turns into not so great of an exchange. But I will say, there are some knucklehead cops. There are some knucklehead people. And those people will be like that whether they're on duty or off duty, and those citizens are like that at work and not at work. And it's just the nature of what we deal with in life.
Now, the thing that's making a lot of press are those First Friday nights. I was down here a couple of months with you till the wee hours. I remember looking over at you. You had this look of intense worry on your face. I mean, it must have been like 2 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning. There were still 500 people on the street. All of them, I would say, under 23. Your officers checked a lot of them. A lot of them weren't underage, but drinking. And I remember I turned to you and said, you know, how is this any fun? And your answer was, they're young, you know. This is fun for them. But it seemed like it was never going to end. there had been a shooting, but it was a few blocks away, not in this area. But it's a huge concern. Why is it such a big concern down here?
Well, this is the thing. Like, as you get older, you start to look at life differently. Again, if I was 22 years old or 23 years old and I didn't have a lot of money and I wanted to be in a place that was new and bustling, this is where I would be. This is where I would want to hang out. I mean, they're pretty girls, and, you know, if a lot of these guys are single, they want to go and they want to meet girls and they want to have fun. I get it. But what happens is, when you get such a large group of people in such a confined area, tempers can start to flare. It can turn into something that it wasn't intended to be. So at my age, it's not fun. You know, it's not fun for me to hang out in an environment. But for these guys, it is. So that's what we have to try to figure out. How do we expand this little confined area so that more people can have fun and you're not bumping shoulders and, temperatures don't, you know.
Well, you know, that's what I'm wondering. In 8 months, do you think it's even going to be an issue as this downtown area expands and the bars push further to the east and people will want to go to those areas? You're not going to have this huge concentration in one single block.
That, to me, is the crime prevention through environmental design, SEPTED. Now you're creating an environment.
You mean that cult thing?
I'm going to talk in this voice again. No, what it is it's like, I would imagine, I mean, human nature. You don't have me all pressed up in solitary confinement. I don't have a girl. I can't get in the club. And this guy looked at me wrong and stepped on my new Air Jordans. So now I want to fight. I mean, that's typical young knucklehead mentality. So hopefully when it's spread out and you get to walk around and you get to breathe air and see nice sights, that should change. And that is my hope.
Well, we're talking here with Chris Curtis, the head of the Downtown Rangers, and we're going to wrap it up here. But I just want to say I hope a lot of the officers have your same perspective. Do you still talk with them, you know, about what's going on? And
I talk to them all the time. I'm their confidant.
Do they have your same level of patience and perspective on it, or do they think you're just a... You're like a wildcat. Like, he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's not a cop anymore.
No, I mean, listen, there's a couple things that you can earn, right? I earned my street stripes. You ask the cops, I earned my street stripes. I mean, I wasn't an angel. I've been in trouble on the police department. I got into a little... And, you know, that doesn't make you the guy, but I looked out for my people. I've done some serious things. And I made it to the finish line, you know, and the sheriff gave me my badge. So I did something right. So, I mean, how do people look at me? It's not my business how they look at me, but I know that I get respect from the people that I care to have respect from, and that's what's important. So, and I could tell you right now, you pull a black and white up to that street right there, I can get in it, operate everything, drive down the street, and make an arrest with no assistance from anybody. So that should answer the question. I mean, I'm still, you know, ask Mike Tyson if he could get in the ring and knock somebody out. I don't think so. It's been a while for Mike. You know, I'm still in there.
That's awesome. Thanks so much, Chris. I appreciate you coming on. Hope we'll have you again.
Absolutely, Joe.